Hello, hello, hello. I can't hear anything.
Yeah, it's because you're not plugged in.
Oh, yeah. That makes it tough.
It's super tough. Right here. There we go. Okay, wow. Oh, yeah.
Now you can hear things?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Welcome to the Dark Side Podcast, where we delve into the darkest side of our existences. The morbid, the macabre, the spooky, and the absurd are all fair game as we discuss murders, people sucking on straws, murders, UFOs, cryptids, creepypasta, the paranormal, and the dark depravity of the human soul. I am David, and with me, as always, is Herman and Forrest.
Hey, guys.
What up?
It's going down.
Fucking A. It's Sunday, and we survived that really horrible storm that hit us yesterday in Webster.
Yeah, we did.
Fucking tornado that I drove near.
Mother Nature didn't get us this time.
Yeah, it's good.
It's always fucking good.
It got downtown.
It got real dark and hairy yesterday.
It was a dark and stormy night.
Yeah.
Except it was a dark and stormy morning.
Yeah.
Nothing like waking up in the morning to a tornado warning.
Three of them.
Yeah,
I had three.
Crazy.
Gales are blowing.
I had like two go off. And then like 10 minutes later when me and John are about to go out and get coffee for Dunkin' Donuts, go figure, New Englanders, going to get coffee at Dunkin' Donuts during a tornado. yeah, we ended up doing that, and supposedly, according to the news sources last night, we actually went in the exact direction it was heading, so we were like right behind that motherfucker.
Hey, you survived it. We all did.
Yeah, I'm very happy. Very happy you guys are, because no one died. Yeah.
Exactly.
I was enjoying Rhode Island's lovely weather. I was playing disc golf in the sun.
Nice. Lucky you.
Yeah. Yeah. You had a very different morning.
Oh, yeah. It was not filled with any terror.
Right,
my wife did think I was in Webster.
She did?
Yeah. She said she called me hysterical. She's like, oh, my God, are you okay? I was like, I'm fine. I'm in Rhode Island. It's raining a little.
I told John this was serious after getting that third notification. I was like, fucking A.
This shit just got real.
Yeah.
Speaking of getting real, let's get into our sponsor for today.
Fuck yeah.
Our sponsor for today is...
This episode is brought to you by Agatha's Old Time Arsenic. Are you nostalgic for the poisons of the past? Do you miss simpler days when people got illnesses like scurvy and died of natural causes? We do too. To celebrate those ideal times where...
<I'm sorry>.
To celebrate those ideal times where your word meant something, government alliances were formed on handshake deals, dueling with swords was the preferred dispute resolution, and children begged for change and got trampled by horses in the muddy streets. We at Personal Chemical Solutions and Confections offer Agatha's Old Time Arsenic, a good, wholesome arsenic that is at home in your pantry. Agatha's arsenic is as good at clearing away those pesky aphids on your borage plants as it is easing that special someone from this world to the next. So give Agatha's arsenic and all the great products at Personal Chemical Solutions and Confections a try.
Wow.
Now back to the Darker Side Podcast. All right, guys. What a wonderful sponsor.
Wow, great sponsor.
I mean, they're doing well by doing good.
Exactly. Yeah. I do miss those old times where... Where was that simple?
Before AIDS.
Very simple.
Before AIDS.
All right, guys. Well, let's get into the darker side news stories today. My news story today comes from Mirror.com, and the news story goes, man dies after slipping in bathroom and getting a toilet brush wedged in his skull through his eye socket.
Wow.
All right. A man was killed after he slipped in his bathroom and got a handle of the toilet brush wedged in his skull through his eye socket.
Sorry.
The unnamed 60-year-old was rushed to the hospital near Moscow, but doctors were unable to save him. Surgeons had to open the man's skull in an attempt to remove the brush, which was embedded in his head through his right eye.
And this is in Russia?
I think so, yeah. The victim had slipped on the floor of his bathroom at his home in the town of Istra, and fell on the brush, reported Moscovy Komsomolets newspaper. Please, if I butchered that, which I'm pretty sure I did,
You pronounce it better.
Yeah, exactly. He was given an MRI scan and x-rays plus strong antibiotics by stunned doctors, according to the report.
Hmm.
Holy shit, that picture is horrible.
What?
Oh, that's in
that's
there.
For
oh
show.
My god. Oh.
A disturbing picture, guys. There's a picture attached to this news story, and we will have a link.
We will have a link.
You have to check it out. The toilet brush was cut off immediately above the eye of the patient, but it was not possible to remove the handle straight away.
Oh, God.
He died.
Why would that be facing out of the ground or wherever he was?
So you got the little brush holder thing that points the brush straight up, and he's a man in his 60s, you say?
Yeah. Oh.
So he bought that toilet brush originally at a yard sale, and it's from 1973, so clearly the handle is made out of... drop forged steel.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Not like the plastic one you bought at Target. That's
or the dollar store for a dollar. Yeah, no.
The dollar store one might only poke out.
I mean,
your
I feel bad for this old gentleman. I mean, obviously it was a total accident, but what a way to go.
Yeah.
And I mean, after all the fighting in the hospital and trying to fix it, but he would have never would have did normal life anyway. But good Lord, good Lord.
Did he feel all that, or
Most likely Forrest, and then the brain probably went into shock, and et cetera. So,
God.
Oh, I'm not laughing. I'm laughing because it hurts.
I'm sorry. I laughed earlier. I could feel the tenses.
Oh, good Lord. All right, Forrest, you got a new story for us today, man, don't you?
Yeah, I do. Okay, this is Newsweek. The story is, seems pretty fresh. Oh, yeah, 8318 by Alexandria Hutzler. Okay. Former GOP official allegedly killed family dog with bare hands, says he's the second coming of Christ.
All right. Sounds about on par. Where is this coming from?
Atlanta.
Let's see here.
No, Alabama. Arkansas.
Todd Kinkinen. Sorry if I said that wrong. An ex-GOP official had a run-in with the authorities last month when he allegedly killed his mother's dog with his bare hands in what he described as a spiritual sacrifice.
Good, yeah.
Yeah, some old school, like old book biblical.
You know, the prodigal son returns, you have to sacrifice the family dog. That makes sense.
Right.
Yeah. South Carolina.
Oh, yeah.
Oh.
I have a friend that lives at the beach there.
It's south. It's not deep south. I would have thought it was Florida or something, but...
South Carolina is pretty, depending what part of South Carolina you're at.
South Carolina is lovely, and the people are very nice.
Yes.
Yeah, but the government, not so much.
The people are lovely.
But the people are lovely, and the food is good.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, probably.
I've had nothing but a good time in South Carolina.
So. Go for a visit, peel a sticker off your car before you go. I'll buy you a fresh one when you get back.
Yeah, that's like, oh my God, yeah, don't even get me started. Okay.
So what else happened?
Quoting him, I told you what I think. I mean, I know I'm the second coming of Christ, and I got a command from God to do it, Kinkinen told one of the police officers at the scene, according to an incident report. On July 26, according to a police report, officers were dispatched to 216 Jones Avenue in South Carolina. I am totally fine with including his address. The report says that Jim Kinkinen, Todd's father, called the police to say that his wife, Roxy, was absolutely terrified of their son because he had killed one of their dogs with his bare hands.
If my son did that, I would be absolutely terrified too. Oh.
Damn it, Roxy. Oh.
Because God told him? It's kind of like Son of Sam doing it because, you know.
The dog told him? The dog is God backwards.
Exactly.
Well, is there a connection?
Yeah, I think there is. Maybe. I think there might be some sort of connection there.
I don't know. I can't. It's hard to follow all these stories. I mean, we have that guy from Virginia running for Congress who's a pedophile. He says he wants dads to have the right to be able to abuse their daughters, sexually abuse.
He probably won't win.
Nathan Larson, that's his name.
Yeah. Ugh. Yeah, you did a story on that.
Right now, he has 48% from the party of possibility of getting in. Between other Republicans. So he has a pretty kind of big chance. It's kind of scary.
They're making book on that, huh?
How did this story end?
Let's see here. Officers from Simpsonville Police Department rushed to the residence where the 37-year-old former attorney was living with his parents.
Okay.
You're an attorney, but you're living with your parents.
He's only 34. I mean, come on. You're going to give him at least till 37.
Yeah.
He's got two more years before he gets to move out of the house.
You're kidding me, right? You move out at 18 and you never look back. Leave a cloud of dust behind.
My mom told me we didn't necessarily
move out when we were 18, John.
No.
No, we still hung on there for a little
while. My mom told me 18 and she still gave me another year and a half.
That was nice of her.
That's very sweet of her.
Yeah. I mean, I pay rent, but when I was in college.
Oh, yeah. You got to pay rent. They'll give you 18 years to live under the roof. My kid, still, he's like 5.5 years late on rent, so... I'm going to give him a big old bill when he graduates high school.
Just teach him.
Type it in, boys.
Oh, it's going to be completely line it. Yep.
DCP network.
Exactly.
Let's see here. When they arrived, they called Todd through the landline phone to tell him that they were outside. That's when Todd Kinkinen allegedly first said that he was sacrificing the family pet. What the fuck's wrong with this dude? Like, we clearly have like a mental problem in this country.
Well, I mean, he's 37 problem. Years old, and he's living with his mother.
That's a good sign. That's number one.
We could see maybe where he went nuts.
Or we have a money greed problem. Could be that. Who knows?
Who knows?
Let's see. When officers entered the house to get Roxy out safely from the bathroom, they found the dog dead on the kitchen floor in a pool of blood. It allegedly had several stab wounds.
Oh, God.
And had defecated during the fight. There were three other dogs in Roxy's bedroom that were not harmed during the incident.
Well, good for I'm very happy the other ones weren't.
That's kind of, I mean, it's a happy ending, but that's still kind of sad, you know, like.
Well, that Roxy got away and the other dogs got away. That's a very good outcome.
Roxy's the wife.
Unfortunately, one of them had to take it for the team.
I believe I looked this up, and I'm not going to Google it because that's no fun. I believe that Roxy was the most popular dog name in 2011.
What the fuck?
Interesting.
That's a crazy fact.
That's another weird connection. We're building webs, guys.
Oh, my God. Yeah. Conspiracy people.
It's a rich fabric.
Yeah. Oh, thanks, Forrest. That was a wonderful news story. Too bad. I mean, I really feel bad for the dog. The dog didn't need to die. God didn't tell this man to kill the dog.
Yeah.
You don't know.
I don't, and John, thank you for pointing that out.
I'm sure there's going to be a horror movie.
We don't know. I have a preconceived notion because of my beliefs, but...
There's going to be a horror
movie.
You don't know.
You don't know. I don't know.
Yeah.
All right, guys. Well, that was the Darker Side news stories. We're going to get into the Darker Side movie review.
Fuck yeah.
This week, we are going to be reviewing The Boy.
Yeah.
I think there are a couple movies out there called The Boy, but...
Their marketing was great. Yeah, I just have to put that out there.
This is a 2016 joint, mystery slash thriller. Yeah, I guess you could call it that.
Don't they also say it's a paranormal movie? Mm. Didn't they like classify it that?
Possibly. I'll read the description here in a second. But it runs at an hour and 38 minutes. Let's see here. A young American named Greta, which is Lauren Cohen from The Walking Dead.
Mm-hmm.
Takes a job as a nanny for an 8-year-old boy in a remote English village. To her surprise, Greta learns that the child of her new employees is a life-size doll. They care for the doll as if it was a human, which helps the couple to cope with the death of their own son 20 years earlier. When Greta violates the list of strict rules, a series of disturbing and inexplicable events bring her worst fears to life, leading her to believe that the doll is alive.
Mm-hmm.
Ooh. Ooh. Doll movies, they're hip and fun. I mean, they scare the shit out of me. I can't look at a porcelain face doll. Fuck that shit. But this movie was directed by a William Brent Bell. The box office USD was $64.2 million. Not bad.
It came out a year after they premiered it in Russia.
Yeah, exactly. Germany and Russia back in 2016. Yep. Yeah.
That's interesting.
Their budget officially on this, and you can tell that they really didn't do, they didn't leave the grounds of this home during this, but the budget was $10 million.
That's pretty high for a horror film.
The screenplay was by Stacey Meiner. 6 out of 10 IMDb, 28% Rotten Tomato.
Yep.
You said 60 earlier as we were talking, but it's only
28%. Well, 60 on IMDb.
Okay. Metacritic. 42% and 84% like this movie on Google. And again, I think Google users, I love your product. They're not really good with the ratings here.
I think I have to say this is a funny thing because nowadays Rotten Tomatoes seems to be more in the right than IMDb. But around this time, IMDb was making way more sense with horror films than Rotten Tomatoes. Metacritic's pretty fair. 42% for a horror film, that's not bad for Metacritic.
I still wouldn't even call it a low-intensity thriller.
A low-intensity thriller.
I didn't really... I mean, like...
38 like, minutes of boredom in the beginning. That's low-intensity.
Yeah, and then an hour, like the second act, which was just all this crazy psychological bullshit.
Oh, the movie, it spirals out of control. Like,
and then the third act is all of that last 15 minutes of the movie.
That you don't expect, yeah.
Right. Especially that weird twist at the end.
I seriously think the 98-minute film time, I thought that was pretty fair for a horror film. I hate seeing movies that are like 70 minutes, and you're just like, what? It just ended?
That one could have been 45 minutes, and I would have been okay with it.
Yeah, probably about an hour five, I would have handled even more. So.
Really?
Yeah, it would have made a nice short.
So, I mean, I did like some of the camera work, especially the first scene of the pull out of the house as she's walking up to it.
The cinematography was beautiful.
You know, and it really was. And it was a little, obviously, it's a dark house. It's an old English home.
Even though, I mean, keep in mind, it's not an American production, so.
It doesn't, I mean, it really doesn't matter. But I think, like, the direction was cool. The acting was okay.
Really? I thought the acting was interesting.
Like Herman said, I maybe got one real jump scare maybe at the end.
I had, like, two or three, I thought. I mean.
I don't know.
Can we just talk about the mulleted boyfriend stereotype trope that showed up? Like, yeah, slack-jawed troglodyte shows up, and he's so poorly acted.
He was horrible. It was horrible.
I'm so sorry.
It was like...
I'm sure he's a nice person, the actor. I should have looked his name up. But, oh man, he was such a stereotype. It was
not the British
beau,
but her American, I'm going to follow you, obsessive boyfriend who she's trying to run away from. That's her whole backstory. That's why she's in England working for the nanny. And then this guy shows up and you're like, get the fuck out of here.
You guys don't like that trope? What?
No, that guy was chewing up the scenery. I mean, absolutely terrible.
I think it could have got more intense, more spooky with just the doll and the boy.
Well, the household caretakers, I thought their acting was, like, not the greatest either. Or whoever, you know,
the parents in the beginning?
Was it the parents in the beginning? I thought their acting was just, eh.
My favorite part of that movie was they were both wearing wingtips. They were really nice British wingtips. I mean, I would kill for a pair of those, especially the brown ones. They were the ones women were wearing.
Yeah.
They were the manliest woman shoes I've ever seen, and I would wear those right now. I would have them on my feet with the shorts and this tank top.
I love how, like, when they're leaving, he's all like, you have no idea. We haven't been away from the house in a long time.
We haven't gone on holiday in forever, in ages.
In ages. In
come, ages. Martha, let us away hence. Hie thee hence to the seaside.
well, they show all these clues throughout the movie, but I didn't pick up on them.
Oh.
Did you guys?
It's pretty obvious.
Because the tension shifts so much in the movie. Like, the first half hour, they just want you to think it's like a paranormal thing. And then I don't want to give anything else away, but like... Then after those like 40 minutes, the whole movie just shifts and you're just like, what the hell's going on? Like, you know,
again, the boyfriend trope just gets in the way of some of the story. it could have easily progressed without him. And yes, it builds that stupid tension. But,
it does.
But come on.
They want you to think he's like, you know, he's involved with whatever's going on or whatever.
I don't know. I would say, you know, watch it. That's one of my opinions is give it a watch. It's an hour and a half. It's not going to take too much of your life away.
It's almost 100 minutes, but it's not bad.
I'd rather watch, I don't know, 8 episodes of Hunting Hitler on History Channel, which I'm currently doing right now. but we could review that as a whole thing, as a whole other episode. But so the boy, I don't know. I personally would give it...
You thought the reviews were fair, like from Rotten Tomatoes?
Yes. I would say more like...
I mean, it's
I would
it's
give
okay.
it in between, maybe like a 35 out of 100 or 3.5 out of 10.
There has been good horror movies that get like 30s from Rotten Tomatoes.
Yeah, sure. but this one, honestly, dude, I think, I feel like it's been done. The toy thing could really scare me, and it did as a child.
Yeah.
Thanks to Chucky and then Annabelle. And
this didn't creep you out at all? Creep me out a little bit.
No, because, no. No.
Damn.
No, so what would you give it?
Let's keep in mind, like, percentage, you know, average percentages from these websites, obviously for horror films is way lower. Like, getting a 30 from Rotten Tomatoes is saying the movie is, like, okay. Or getting, like, a 42 on Meta, that's pretty much saying the movie is okay.
Right.
To be fair, if you got a 30 on your homework assignment, you failed your homework assignment.
Well, yeah, so I guess the movie failed to get the majority to like the movie, I guess.
Yeah, but what does Forrest think? Forget about Metacritic or Google's or the internets in general.
I say it was a very creative film. Obviously, you could tell there was a lot of thought that went into this movie. I did appreciate the weird distribution this movie had. And I would agree with IMDb. I'd give it like probably a 6.5 out of 10.
That's not a bad review.
Yeah. I didn't love it. But like, John, without giving anything away, there was just one scene like towards like the last half hour.
John, your partner, John?
Yeah, my okay. fiance, John. Yeah. Towards the last half hour of the film, you know, that you have that big reveal scene, and he did not like the way they did that.
I agree with your man toy.
He was like yelling at me the whole way home. He was like, "Why did you bring me this movie? We paid money for this." I'm like, "Shut up." I thought it was good.
I pay a monthly subscription to Netflix to watch this movie.
We saw it in IMAX.
I did just buy Netflix specifically to watch this movie.
Yeah, but there'll be some more movies we're going to be watching on it, Joe.
Netflix has tons of great, they have tons of great movies.
So what'd you think of it, Herman?
I agree with Forrest's fiancé. I don't know, man. It's not for me. It's not for me. It was like, what I liked the best was, I kept looking at that house and going, this was used as a Wayne Manor one time. I swear to God, the staircase looked like the Wayne Manor staircase from the Batman movie from 1990, or 91, whenever that came out. And that was like distracting to me because I was like, all right, staircase is super familiar. It's been in something else.
Yeah.
And of course I didn't look it up because I wasn't that interested. But overall, I mean, they've done better horror movies with dolls. I've seen better reveals, and quite frankly, I found that it dragged.
See, I didn't mind that like extra 20 minutes you get at the end. You're just like, what is this?
No, I'd love to give my real opinion, but I'd have to ruin the movie. But John Carpenter did it better in several of his movies.
Yeah.
He was a co-writer. I'm pretty confident he was like a co-writer in this film.
I don't know. It doesn't say anything. It doesn't say anything on the description here. No. I mean, he could very well have been an executive producer.
He could have taken his name off because the movie did flop in theaters. Mm, okay.
But I agree with Herman. What would you give it out of a whatawa? Did you?
Yeah, I'm like 30, 35 out of 100, yeah. 3.5. Yeah.
Damn. Yeah. Holy shit.
So that is our opinion of that movie.
I like that pop movie better.
What is it? Six?
What was that movie?
666% of the
Darkest Side
podcast. Darkest Side podcast agrees that it is a 3.5.
Hey.
66.6 repeating.
So 6667.
Google gave it a pretty good overrating. Holy crap. Got an 84 out of 100.
Yeah.
Yeah. But who uses that Google? Have you ever reviewed a movie on Google? Case closed.
Doing a little bit of research, you guys are actually opinionating with the audience on Rotten Tomatoes. The audience gave it a 38.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's fair.
It's about fair.
Ugh, no.
All right.
We're everymen. We're average everymen.
It should have at least gotten like a 50.
Yeah. Oh, well.
I'll give it that, but still, it failed.
All right. Well, that was the Darker Side movie review for The Boy. All right, guys. Well, we're going to dive deeper into The Darker Side. But before we get into that, we just want to let you know that Forrest had to leave. So the rest of this episode is going to be me and Herman discussing the 1974 Chihuahua, Mexico UFO crash. Herman, what do you got for us?
So this is going to be a two-parter, so gird your loins.
Gird them. Gird those loins, everyone.
All right, in 1974 is famous for two things. One, 1974 is famous for two things. First, the Brady Bunch was canceled after 5 seasons. And on August 25th, 1974, at the U.S. Naval Station in Corpus Christi, Texas, at 10:07 p.m., radar operators saw something on the screen, a flying object about 200 miles out, heading towards the town at 2,500 miles an hour, flying at 75,000 feet. Now, this happens to be a little faster than the planes that we had at the time, the fastest production plane ever, at that time anyway, was the SR-71 Blackbird, and it's only capable of speeds of 2,193 miles per hour. Also, it didn't fly much over 50,000 feet. Of course, there was the X-15, which was a rocket-propelled plane that was clocked at 4,520 miles an hour, but the X-15 was not a production aircraft. We would have known if it was flying anyway.
Yeah.
So, what was this object that was flying at 75,000 feet at 2,500 miles an hour? The course, its heading, as it were, had the UFO arriving in American airspace at 40 miles south of Corpus Christi, Texas. Naturally, this got everyone's attention, and Ellington Air Force Base in Houston started to track the thing with their long-range radar. Then it slowed down to 1,950 miles per hour. Jesus. changed its heading 290 degrees and began its descent. No doubt after turning on the fastened seatbelt sign and putting the various tray tables in their upright positions.
290 degree turn?
Yeah.
At 1,000 something miles per hour.
At 1,950.
Jesus.
Yeah, that did more than just bang a Huey.
Literally.
Yeah. So our military does what it does. They put everyone on alert and got the fighter pilots ready to rock.
Suit up, boys.
Yeah. Get after it, gentlemen. So not that they could catch it, but at 1,950 miles, they probably could have scrambled their SR-71 Blackbird and got it going as fast as it possibly could go. I don't know if you want to chase something with a spy plane, but that's neither here nor there.
Yeah.
At 10:10 p.m., it turned again, veered west, and headed for Old Mexico at about 45,000 feet. The changes in speed and direction, the author of this book notes, and I should give him credit. I got a lot of the information for this particular episode from a book called Mexico's Roswell, The Chihuahua UFO Crash by No Torres and Ruben Uriate. And I hope I pronounced their names right. They did a great job with this.
I think those two writers are they Mexican writers or were they?
You know, I didn't look into their history.
I think that they're native from that general area, the two authors.
That would make sense because they definitely went into the area and, you know, poked around. Anyway, so the author of this book, excuse me, indicated that the UFO was being steered by intelligent life. And he says that because of the changes in speed and changes in direction. One of the authors, Ruben Uriate, stated in a History Channel interview that, quote, this object was traveling and descending through steps, unlike that of a meteor, which is more of an arc.
Right.
Yeah, meteors don't just bang a Huey in the sky.
Unless they hit an invisible force field.
Oh, that's true.
Yeah.
Or Superman catches it and sends it back out into space.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because that's happened. What's remarkable about the flight of this craft is that it had appeared at 75,000 feet. Now, the author speculates that it descended into radar view, but it could have just as easily have risen into radar view or even just appeared.
Right. From nowhere or either underwater.
Yeah. Rising up into radar because they don't scan everything. Right. Otherwise, it'd be following, you know, buzzards and stuff.
Exactly.
And in less than 30 minutes, it had streaked almost 500 miles and was over the Chihuahuan Desert. So the Chihuahua Desert in Mexico. When something interesting happened, it disappeared from the radar screens.
Just altogether?
Just completely disappeared. So after which, the military understandably watched the radar for another 20 minutes and then gave up.
Right?
Yeah.
What are you going to do?
Yeah. It appeared, it flew around, it started to descend, and it disappeared. So the Chihuahua Desert is a remote area of 140,000 square miles, covering the northwest corner of Mexico, southwest Texas, southern New Mexico, and parts of Arizona.
So it's like literally right on the U.S.-Mexico border.
Yeah.
Like the line goes through that desert.
Yeah. Yeah. It's if you've seen a movie that involves cowboys and going to Mexico, that's the kind of desert you're looking at. Rugged mountains, all that. It is bordered by two mountain ranges, the Sierra Madre Occidental and the Sierra Madre Oriental.
One Orients and one Occidents.
Yeah, I don't honestly know what is meant by either of those.
Those are probably some geological terms or, you know, they're probably originally on the same mountain range and then tectonically something happened and pushed them in different directions.
Put a lot of sand in
between. Yeah.
The terrain consists of basins broken by numerous small mountain ranges, and I'd like to thank Wikipedia for that information. If you want more information on the Chihuahua Desert, please don't ask me, because that's about as far as I went with it. The desert's also known to be a bit of a hotspot for bizarre activity. Reports include flickering lights near the mountains, interruptions of readings for aircraft instruments, and of course, UFO sightings of all kinds.
Well, it'd be a perfect place to put an underground base, right?
Oh, yeah. It's
to build a subterranean base for these UFOs or flying objects.
It's beautiful and it is very inhospitable.
Which is a perfect place to put something like that.
Mm.
Especially if there's not a lot of people coming in and out of it.
It gets better. So the authors of this book actually went down there and they interviewed a local man who lived in that area by the name of Jorge Gonzalez Almeida, who said, quote, I have seen a lot of strange and unexplained things in the skies above the ranches. I personally have witnessed numerous unexplained phenomenon in the area, and I have also heard many stories from others. And I did forget to mention that the mountains in this region are rich in uranium.
Huh. With it. Yeah, huh.
Okay.
Interesting. Oh, it makes sense now.
Some locals believe that the uranium explains the glowing lights near the mountains and some of the other phenomena.
I mean, that, you have to have a large amount of uranium for it to produce that amount of glowing for you to see it at any distance.
Yeah, I wouldn't want to go near it if it was.
Yeah, exactly.
But these two gentlemen from the book, they went down there, so that's pretty impressive. So back to the craft. 30 minutes before the object was sighted, a small civilian aircraft bound for Mexico took off from El Paso International Airport. What's interesting to note is that no one actually knows who was on the plane, what they were doing, or even what kind of plane it actually was. The authors of the book speculate that it was a Cessna or something of that ilk. They just say that it was a personal craft, and that it headed out over the mountains to Mexico. After an hour, the plane was 200 miles away over the town of Coyome, which is roughly 50 miles from Texas.
In Mexico?
In Mexico, okay. Yeah. Coyome, Mexico. Thank you. Somewhere around 10:30, the plane disappeared from the radar and was presumed to have crashed near Coyome. Word reached Mexico's local military, who began planning for a rescue mission to begin at dawn. Searching the vast and rugged Chihuahuan desert at night would probably be dangerous and unsuccessful even for a highly trained military outfit.
Yeah.
I mean, seriously, if you look at pictures of this place, it's rugged mountains and sand and
reflective surfaces. Yeah. And just very difficult, especially at night. It would just absorb all the light. And
those little cactus that like jump and attach to you when you get near them. I forgot the name of those things. But yeah, no, it's nasty. So let's connect the dots on this a little bit. There's an aerial vehicle traveling faster than any plane could at the time. It appears at 75,000 feet off the coast of Texas, flies to Mexico, and disappears. Meanwhile, a civilian plane takes off from El Paso and disappears in the same desert at the same time.
Hmm.
How does that happen, Dave?
Maybe the UFO attached itself to the plane and disappeared with it?
Sure. And the dog lives, too. Eventually, folks are going to figure out that the plane and the unknown craft collided over the mountains in the desert. It's presumed that the crash occurred between 3,000 and 7,000 feet, with the plane traveling at 150 miles and the UFO somewhere around 2,000 miles per hour.
That doesn't really make for a good end for at least, probably both vehicles.
Yeah, I would say. The plane's not going to do all that well.
Yeah.
Spoiler alert. Quote from Uriate, quote, "The crash may have been caused by both craft colliding at a lower altitude due to their vision being blocked by a high peak, hills, or a mountain."
True.
In other words, both craft met at the intersection of a mountain. If the plane was flying south and the craft was flying west, the pilot could not have seen anything on his left until he cleared the mountain, colliding with the craft in front of him.
Hmm. Well, yeah.
So yeah, think of a vehicle approaching an intersection, blocked by a large building on the driver's left. If you go into that intersection, you could crash into a speeding car coming from your left because you can't see it because there's a building there.
Especially if it's going 10 times faster than you are?
Yes. If the car is going 2,000 miles an hour and you're going 150, it's not going to be a pretty thing. You don't have time to react. So if you were to go into that intersection, you could crash into the speeding car coming from the left. And it's either best to stay there until you dehydrate and die, or turn around and let your GPS reroute you.
Right.
According to Uriate and Torres, little did they realize that on the warm August night in 1974, that this isolated region was about to move front and center in an amazing race between two governments to recover extraterrestrial technology from a crashed spaceship.
Dun, 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 dun.
We'll sell you the whole seat, but you'll only need the edge.
Yeah, this actually does become a very intense race between both of our governments. And I think on that border anyway, with the whole UFO thing, there was obviously tensions. And I mean, that border has been a tension from America and Mexico for quite some time. And even in the, 70s, they still, both of those governments were stubborn back then.
There's a lot of history going on with Mexico and in the U.S. as we'll see in a bit regarding crashed items.
Yeah,
more on that later. So Mexico began their search Monday, August 26th, 1974, and the U.S. hadn't quite put the pieces together yet. So there's the U.S. Thinking that a flying object just disappeared off the screen. They hadn't quite figured out about the civilian plane. Mexico, I don't think, knew about the UFO because they scrambled a rescue team. And from all evidence, it appears that they thought this was just going to be a simple airline rescue operation.
Right.
You know, go in, if there's anybody living, save them. And if not, just pick up the pieces and bring it back and call the loved ones, whatever. So they sent out a U.S. spotter plane, I should say, was flown near Coyome at dawn and found the site of the crash north of the Rio Grande.
So the U.S. got there first.
We sent a plane. Yep. We had spy satellites trained on the thing. I mean, we were keeping an eye.
Okay.
So north of the Rio Grande at the El Paso Intelligence Center, EPIC, which is the best name for a military outfit I've ever heard.
Yeah. Superpower metal.
No kidding. The U.S. military were monitoring the progress and indeed the communications surrounding this operation very closely.
Of course. They had their eyes. This object showed up in U.S. airspace. They wanted to know what it was.
Absolutely.
It was in our airspace and eventually crossed over the border and then had gotten that accident at that point. That's when we lost it on radar.
Yeah, so here's what here's what the U.S. knows. They know that this streaking thing came in, disappeared over Coyome.
Super hot.
And they also know now, because they're paying attention to the communications, they now know that Mexico has a bunch of people going out to a crashed plane.
Because one of their planes who left one of their airports...
They left the U.S. coming back to Mexico.
Oh, okay.
Never landed, which is why we weren't all that interested. Because when a plane leaves the U.S. and doesn't land in the U.S., we look at that.
Right.
We're like, okay, this plane just disappeared. We have the FAA. They do their thing.
Now it's Mexico's problem.
This is Mexico's problem.
Right.
Which, to be fair, really should be the title of this. This is Mexico's problem.
Right.
What are we doing? But anyway, so a bit on EPIC. They existed to stem the flow of illegal drugs, had access to spy satellites, and also had military planes like the EP-3 Ares capable of flying over Coyome, taking pictures, and coming back to the U.S. in minutes. At 10:30 a.m., Mexican and indeed U.S. official ears heard the crackling report of the Mexican military pilot on his reconnaissance mission. Signs of a crashed plane were discovered in the desert. It was said to have been almost totally destroyed, and mere moments later, the radio came to life again. The pilot spotted a second, quote-unquote, plane, a few miles away from the first downed aircraft. It was described as being, quote, nearly circular in shape, with a silver metallic finish that glinted in the hot Mexican sun. Though the craft, end quote, the craft had only sustained superficial damage. Realizing this, the pilot reported that it was en una pieza, which sounds Italian, but means in one piece.
Interesting.
Hearing this, the U.S. military quickly began to draw up plans to bring in more surveillance in the Coyome area and prep the team for a possible, quote, rapid deployment into Mexico, end quote, to recover the craft.
A.K.A. let's beat those bitches to the scene.
Oh. Yeah, that's the one. Yeah, Operation Beat Those Bitches to the Scene, to put it in the parlance of our times.
Yes.
So cheap and abundant military information is kind of like anything else. Easy come, easy go. The Mexican officials, realizing something odd was happening, ordered radio silence to take effect, and there goes the U.S. military's free info. The U.S. military had heard enough and sent what they knew at the time back to the Central Intelligence Agency in Langley, Virginia, who immediately got involved. It was reported that CIA Director William Colby, quote, may, end quote, have... contacted President Gerald Ford, who, as the book points out, in 1966, while in Congress, said, on the record, quote, I believe Congress should thoroughly investigate the rash of reported sightings of unidentified flying objects, because the American people are intensely interested in UFO stories, and some people are even alarmed by them, end quote. That's our former president. Gerald Ford. He clammed up as soon as he got in the Oval Office. Yeah. Done. He never said another word about it.
Right.
Which is interesting.
Is interesting.
Okay. So in the early afternoon on Monday, August 26th, a Mexican recovery team in a convoy of vehicles with up to 24 soldiers, several flatbeds and jeeps shows up at the first crash site. The trained soldiers made short work of the obliterated small downed private plane. They're used to this sort of thing.
Right.
And as you can well imagine, in that desert in Mexico, I'm sure this is not the first plane they've had to pick up.
No. I mean, that's a lot of open air.
Yeah.
You know, things happen, unfortunately.
Wind, uranium, screwed up instruments.
UFOs.
UFOs. I mean, exactly. Yeah. So many things.
Anything. Those invisible barriers I was talking about earlier.
Yeah. Yeah. The Nazca lines. I don't even know if that comes into play. It's not even in that area, but it could. It could.
Never. You never know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was well researched. So not to be left out, the U.S. government began diplomatically offering to quote unquote assist as the plane had flown out of El Paso, even though it had Mexican tags. The U.S. felt justified in helping as the aircraft had had caused an alert in America. So clearly we're involved.
It's our problem. We're involved now. Oh. Let's get our hands into it.
Yeah, the plane we forgot about took off from one of our airports, so we gotta go.
At least to investigate.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. We're compelled. Right. Nay, obliged to help.
Exactly.
I'm not sure why, but the Mexican government was hesitant to accept this assistance.
Yeah.
Now, back to our relationship with Mexico in the... let's go back to the 1940s. There is a pattern of U.S. assistance with aerial crash landings in Mexico. In the 1940s, we'd actually launched a lot of rockets, which came down in Mexico. You'll remember Wernher von Braun, our space program. It started somewhere, and it wasn't always successful.
Right.
The authors of the book report that we had at the time sort of a carte blanche, just go in and grab them. Attitude with Mexico, kind of like a back channel agreement. Hey, when we lost another one of our rockets, the Mexican military would go to the site, sift through the debris, the U.S. would drive it back to El Paso and see what went wrong. So it's possible then that the U.S. Thought this would continue in this instance, or that the military near the crash did not, you know, get the memo, as it were.
Right.
Or that the CIA operatives in the Mexican government couldn't exactly sway the right officials. At any rate, the Mexican military arrived at the scene of the second crash without the assistance of the United States.
So they first showed up on the scene. I mean, because they were there, they had the ability to, and they'd already cleaned up the small plane crash. Now this second crash scene, they show up first, obviously. I mean, they had troop, you know, feet on the ground at that point.
Yeah, they had the right kit to go grab stuff.
Right.
Sort of. When they got to the second crash site, what they saw was literally otherworldly. Crashed in the desert sand was a shiny metal disc, 16 feet 5 inches in diameter, and just under 5 feet from top to bottom. Quote, it was equally convexed on both the upper and lower surfaces, and there were no doors, windows, lights, or evident means of propulsion. It was simply a smooth and silver-colored classic flying saucer shape. And that's Uriarte.
So Uriarte, but where did he get this information from? From firsthand accounts, or
there was a report that was leaked to these guys.
Yeah,
specifically was sent to them. The name of the report's escaping me, but we'll find that by the end of this.
Okay.
But yeah, there was a supposed military report that was leaked to these two gentlemen, and they began their
like a declassified report.
Yes.
Okay.
So that's where they got all their information. They packaged it up nicely in this book that you can pick up off of Amazon for less than $10, and it got in the hands of yours truly. And here, the rest is history,
exactly,
as they say.
Yes.
So there were no markings, writings, or symbols anywhere on this craft. There was damage, and it was noted as a 2-foot-wide dent in the side and a small irregular hole about 12 inches in diameter, you know, nothing the shop couldn't fix.
And an obliterated plane.
And the plane was a, yeah.
Yeah. Vapor, basically.
Smoking wreckage, yeah. Miles away. This hole did have the potential to vent whatever was inside the craft to the outside environment.
Yeah.
So think about that one.
Right.
Now, the men recovering the craft were wearing no protective gear of any kind. Most likely they set out having made the somewhat logical assumption that this was your standard issue recovery of an aircraft of Earth origin. Because why would you believe anything else? However... I'd like to reiterate that there was a hole in this craft, and the unknown contents of the unidentified craft were freely escaping out of this 12-inch hole.
Interesting. So there was a gas-ish, like a gaseous type substance or an air, or they don't know, it's just a substance?
They have no idea.
Interesting.
Whatever it was exposing the soldiers to a mysterious contaminant as the craft was loaded onto the flatbed truck. The U.S., meanwhile, was using all of its toys to monitor the Mexican activities. They saw the craft safely stowed on the truck, watched the convoy as it proceeded back across the desert heading to Chihuahua City, and then the remarkable happened. The convoy just stopped.
What?
Sitting there in the Mexican desert.
Just stopped.
Just sitting in the desert were all these trucks and jeeps.
Huh.
Now, high-altitude flyovers can tell part of the story. So the order was given at Fort Bliss to send a low-altitude reconnaissance jet over the scene to figure out why the convoy stopped in the middle of the Chihuahua Desert.
This is interesting. I mean, obviously, this convoy has stopped for quite some time if they can deploy these types of craft to get to them. It's not just like a quick stop because Jorge has to piss on the side of the road.
They can turn and burn these things in, like, less than half an hour.
Okay.
And they do. The timing from when they sent it to when it got to... Because you're going 50 miles an hour in a military reconnaissance vehicle. That's fast.
Right.
And they're going over the desert. They can break the sound barrier without people noticing.
True.
So in the photos that were returned to Fort Bliss, one could clearly see the vehicles and that they were no longer moving. But upon closer inspection... One could also see that several vehicle doors were opened and two human bodies lay beside the vehicles in the Chihuahua Desert sand. There was no signs of life, just two bodies and stopped vehicles.
Huh. What?
And that's where I'm going to end part one.
That's a very, very interesting mystery we got going on there, John.
Hmm.
What could possibly have happened?
What could happen?
Hmm. Wow, dude. I can't wait for part two. I mean, I know a little bit about the 74 Chihuahua crash, but man, this story is deep.
It's crazy. And I got to say, this book, the Mexico's Roswell, absolutely worth reading. Super fun. It's a good read. They definitely, they get very detailed into a lot of specific things like the vehicles that would or could have been used and the rockets that may have landed in Mexico that we might have shot off and stuff like that. So there's a little bit, it's a little bit speculative, but it's a good read and very interesting story. I definitely recommend that. I pulled a lot of information from there. There's some stuff from Epoch Times and whatnot. And like always, I'll make sure that all of that stuff is cited so you guys can check it out. But
awesome.
I highly recommend the book. They did do a History Channel, like Ancient Aliens thing on this, maybe 10 years ago that I can't find.
Interesting.
Yeah. I was looking for it. Maybe I'm bad at researching old videos from television because they're proprietary and whatnot, but I absolutely couldn't find it.
Yeah.
So I was going to write the History Channel and just be like, where is this video?
Where is it? Well, dude, that was awesome. So that is the 1974 Chihuahua, Mexico UFO crash part one. We are going to get back to you guys next week with a part two and some more fun news stories, I'm sure. Well, that was the Darker Side podcast for today. I am David Pottle. You can find me on the social medias. That's it.
Yeah, yeah. Find the Darker Side on Facebook. Friend us, love us, hate us. Tell us about how you feel. You can find me on Instagram at Herman Brow. That's where you can send me pictures of your cats or iguanas or spiders if you're one of those weird people.
Yeah, check out the DCP Network, guys, and also all of our other podcasts, Glit F or Getting Lost in the Forest. Forrest would appreciate that. Please rate and review us if you can. That'll just help us out any further. And thanks to all of our Patreon users. You guys are the best. The Darker Side Podcast. You.
We were crashed.